for coming to this. I think it is the fourth in our series. Topic is changed slightly from what was on the flyer. The flyer originally was from FIFA to Pan Am, bribes, conflict of interest, and the public trust. But the truth of the matter is that for all of the different complaints people have about the Pan Am Games, I haven't heard anything about bribes and conflict of interest. And so I... Yeah, that's true. Sometimes, you know, you have to wait until afterwards. Nonetheless, I changed it to from FIFA to the Senate scandal, which actually worked well, because what I want to talk about are three different issues within bribery and conflict of interest. And it'll correspond quite well to different scandals that we're familiar with. There is a sign-in sheet going around. Please make sure to sign in. If you want to get notification of future lunches here, then make sure to enter your email address. There's also an option to join the weekly email list that publicizes the programs that I do in general. But we begin by looking at the first two sources, which are of critical importance. Source number one is a midrash on a verse. The biblical verse says, "Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol," which means, "Do not put a stumbling block in front of the blind." And on a literal level, you could read that and say, "Okay, you see a blind person on the street, you know, don't put something in his way." But we take it also beyond the literal to say, "Don't give people bad advice." And one particular type of bad advice is bad advice that one gives due to conflict of interest. So that in the first source there, you see the sage's comment, you shouldn't tell somebody, "Sell your field and buy a donkey," when you have a donkey you want to get rid of and you're looking to buy the guy's field. You know, you'll say, well, it's good advice for him, but realistically, you have a conflict of interest. Your interest is in getting his field and getting rid of your donkey. So that's not an acceptable way to do business. And if that's on a simple sort of personal level, where it becomes more complicated and where the demands become greater is when you're dealing with somebody who is responsible for public funds. Someone who is dealing not only in his own property, but is dealing in money donated by the community. He's dealing in a nonprofit. He's dealing in a governing position. So that if you take a look at source number two, this is a rabbinic comment on a biblical verse talking about the appointment of judges over the Jewish people. When the Jews are in the wilderness, Moses assigns people the role of being judges. And the biblical text says, as you see in the beginning of source number two, I instructed your judges at that time, saying, dot, dot, dot. And so the rabbis comment that he's telling them, you are now judges. That in and of itself is an instruction. He's saying, in the past, you were in your own domain. You could do what you wanted within your own domain. You have restrictions, but you have fundamental freedom. Now, guess what? You are slaves bound to the community. When you work for the community, when you hold a public position, the expectations are different for what you're going to do. And also, the expectations for your standards of behavior are different, are elevated, as we'll see. So that I want to look at three recent, or relatively recent, scandals and the insights we can get within Jewish law about those three. So the first one I brought you had to be FIFA. There was no way we were not going to talk about that. And I brought you a piece of an article from the CBC in source number three, but really, you had to be hiding somewhere very dark in order not to be aware of the revelations. This is regarding this fellow Chuck Blazer, who acknowledged having accepted bribes and kickbacks, as you see there, in conjunction with the broadcast and other rights to the 1996, 98, 2000, 2002, and 2003 Gold Cups. And the whole saga is still unfolding. But FIFA identifies itself on its website as, quote, an association of associations. They are not-for-profit, supposedly. They and they are the governing body, as they put it, for the individuals, correct. But they talk about how all the funds that they bring in go into development of soccer worldwide. You know, a lot of it probably goes into trying to sell it to Americans, not yet succeeding. You can beg to differ. I'm an American. But the issue there is, this is a nonprofit, and these are board members of a nonprofit. And so the question is, what do we expect of people in that situation? That's one level. Second level is the level of government. And I brought you a piece in source number 4. Again, this is relatively familiar to people, but I brought it because I liked what John Oliver had to say. Mm-hmm. Talking about the Senate scandal in which they do an audit that finds $1 million in misspent funds. It costs them $24 million to do the audit. I don't know if Kurt Zelitsky-Feldman was involved in this.
Unfortunately not. Exactly. But we're looking for
you're open for business, right? But yeah, what they are dealing with are claims made on again on funds that are entrusted to the government for uses that are inappropriate. And so the question is, when you're dealing with public officials, what is the expectation of Jewish law, Jewish ethics? What is the standard to which we hold them, and how do we define conflict of interest for them? And then the third is actually not about an official at all, but it's about citizens. In source number 5, I brought you a piece from the end of 2013 when allegations were made that Doug Ford was buying votes because he was on camera handing out $20 bills to residents of a public housing building. It didn't look so good. His argument was that, you know, candidates get to give out gift certificates or whatever, so I just, you know, streamlined the process. It's their money now. They can use it and spend it however they choose. I don't have to stand online getting gift certificates. I just gave them the money straight. And the truth of the matter is that vote buying goes on all the time. Maybe not as obviously as, you know, handing somebody money and saying, vote for me. But when you have a minister who lobbies for, let's say, the building of a military base in his area because he wants there to be jobs and he wants them to be able to employ people locally, or a casino, or a fill-in-the-blank, whatever it is. Any time a politician says, I am going to support a particular agenda because it is popular with the people who are voting and I want to get their vote, to a certain extent, that's democracy. Like, that's the way things are supposed to work. You vote for the person who supports the policies that you want to see in practice. On the other hand, what is the expectation of a voter? Is the voter supposed to say, I'm going to ignore my personal profit and vote for what I believe is good for the nation as a whole and separate out those two? Or is it okay for him to be bought, so to speak? For him to say, you know what, they're now supporting the politicians are now supporting a tax cut, it's going to help me, and therefore that's who I'm going to vote for. Is it okay for me to do that? Am I allowed to sell my vote to elected officials?
Isn't it a function is whether that person is voting in because of himself or because of what he stands for?
Certainly.
So basically what I'm saying is if that person is voting because of the person that he is, and people are voting for him, and he can do basically whatever he wants to do, it's free reign or free license, whatever he wants, as opposed to if he stands for certain, for whatever it is, and people are voting for his policies or for his views, and therefore he's basically tied to those
theoretically.
Theoretically.
Right, but even within that, there is a possibility of voting for somebody based on his policies because I believe they're good for the country, or voting for him based on his policies because I believe that they're good for me. You know, what's good for me may not be good for the country as a whole. That has to be recognized. So so that's what I brought you in number 5. So those are our 3 issues. Board members of a nonprofit, public officials, and then the average voter. I found 2 articles in particular to be very helpful in preparing this. One is a Hebrew article by Dr. Ron Kleinman from, I think, Bar Ilan University, Megula Moshel, Dayan Le'ola Moshel, Oved HaTzibur. I think that would translate to from the halls of the judge to the world of the public servant. Yeah, that would be a good way to call it. Actually, I think I used it here in one of the sources. Anyway, that's one. And then the other was an article by Rabbi Yehuda Warburg, Self-Dealing in the Not-for-Profit Boardroom. So both of those were helpful in preparing this. So we begin with the board members. Board members of a nonprofit. So would you say that we expect the same, more, or I guess theoretically less, in terms of the standard of conduct and the concern for conflict of interest of a board member on a nonprofit? Yeah. Would you say we expect more or less?
Versus a for-profit or?
So he himself, we can posit it either way, he is paid or is not paid. You know, he could be a trustee who's just, you know, there as a voluntary position, or he could be somebody paid. Either way.
And then you say to expect more versus what?
Versus what you expect from a standard person who should not be giving advice that benefits him while harming the person he is advising, like we saw in source number one.
I think you would expect more because he's got a double tafkid. One is he's a board director, a member of the board, he's a director. And number two, he's like the normal person that can't
Right. So as a board member, you're saying he has a second position, and that position carries greater responsibility. I think intuitively we understand that.
It's not only greater responsibility, but it's also greater responsibility in a lot of cases to the weakest of our society.
Right.
Yes.
You have to look at it in terms of who should be benefiting from this nonprofit. Right? It's feeding the homeless, it's teaching children, it's whatever it is. The beneficiaries of the organization are not in a position to defend their own interests. He is in a position, theoretically, to take advantage of vulnerable people, and maybe that positions him with greater responsibility. So, I think intuitively,
But it's also an issue with numbers, because a person is responding to his own interest. As a board member, he's responding to a very large community.
Right. So the interests he has to take into consideration are far beyond his own, as opposed to a one-on-one situation where it's me and the person I'm dealing with. Good point also. The challenge within Judaism is that you need to find a paradigm. And what I mean by that is, it's not sufficient for me to say, I expect more from this person. What I have to understand is, how does Jewish law frame the position of being a board member? When a person joins a board, what are they agreeing to do? In secular law, we have the concept of a fiduciary, right? You accept a degree of loyalty to the organization and responsibility to the organization. So the question is, what is that within Judaism? And Rabbi Warburg, in his article, throws out the idea, and he's not the only one to do it. You see it also in Rabbi Dr. Kleinman's article. But there are at least three different models for how you can look at the position of a board member in Jewish law, and each one will come with its own obligations. The first way you can look at it within Jewish law is that he is what is called in Hebrew a shomer. Okay, a shomer means what?
A watcher.
A watcher, a guardian, correct.
Custodian.
Right. And that's what we have to talk about. But a shomer, this is one of the first things that Jewish kids, when they start learning Talmud, learn about. It's one of the most basic of Talmudic discussions, is the status of a shomer, of a guardian. I am running out of town, and I want to give my whatever it is to somebody to watch. Or you know what? We're sitting in this room, we're having a meeting. At some point, I have to step out. I say, I'm going to be back in an hour. Do me a favor, I'll leave my laptop here. Keep an eye on it, please. What is the responsibility of the person who is now in possession of my laptop? That person is called a shomer, is called a guardian. And there are different levels of responsibility depending on the level of remuneration this person is receiving.
What if there is no remuneration?
So that's what we have to talk about. We distinguish between three categories of cases. Case number one is where all of the benefit accrues to the owner of the item, none to the guardian. Okay, in other words, where I say to him, guard this please, but I'm not paying him to do it. It's all my benefit because he's going to take care of this for me until I come back. And in that case, he has minimal responsibility. He just can't be careless. Okay, if it's an outdoor meeting, clouds are gathering, he has to make sure not to leave it out in the rain. But he has no greater sense of responsibility than don't be careless. Intermediate would be where there is shared benefit, such as I'm going to pay him to guard it. Or in a case in which he's not guarding something, but he's renting something from me. He rents my lawnmower. So he's benefiting because he gets to use a lawnmower. I'm benefiting because he's paying me rent. So in that case, he has a higher degree of responsibility. For example, if he leaves it in his house normally, he didn't do anything wrong, and then somebody breaks in during the night and steals my lawnmower. So in that case, he would be responsible. Even though he's done nothing wrong, he set his alarm and everything else, nonetheless, he would be responsible. The highest degree of liability would be where he gets all the benefit, which is where he's a borrower. Instead of him guarding something for me, or him renting something from me, he borrows my lawnmower. If he borrows a lawnmower, he's not paying me anything. So I'm the good guy. I am giving him all the benefit. He has the highest degree of responsibility. And even if something happens that's entirely beyond his control, lightning strikes his garage and fries my lawnmower, he's going to be responsible for it. Something that you couldn't foresee, you couldn't have known about, doesn't make a difference. The greater his benefit, the greater his responsibility. The point for us in this conversation is, we could legitimately say that a director is a shomer, he's a guardian. He's been entrusted with the money that the organization is collecting and then is supposed to spend. His level of responsibility will depend on what kind of guardian he is. Is he a paid director, or is this a volunteer position? But either way, he will carry responsibility. If you take a look at source number 6, you find a source that in fact calls him a shomer. This is a responsum from the 18th century, I believe, quoted by Rabbi Eisenstadt in 19th century Poland, who talks about the following case. I'm not going to read inside. I'm going to explain cases, but you have the text to look at if you want. He talks about a case in which there is a tzedakah collector. Tzedakah is a donation that is meant to be used for the needy. So there's a collector who goes around the synagogue collecting these funds. In this case, it was to help people buy flour to make matzah for Passover. He collects a whole bunch of money, puts it in his wallet, and then loses his wallet. And so the question is, to what extent is he now responsible, and to whom is he responsible? The case is actually complicated, because the question is, who's going to prosecute him? In other words, there's no individual needy person who had a claim on all of those funds. And the people in the community no longer own it. They donated it. So the question a little bit is, who's the plaintiff in this conversation? So it's a little complicated. But one point that's made, and that's what I brought it for, is that in fact his status is considered to be a guardian. He is appointed by the community's governors, who, you know, they had a, in the old days, the way it was done in Jewish communities was they had a city council. And the city council would appoint the person who was going to be the collector of charity, and he is considered to be a guardian. And that's one way that you can frame this. But it's not the only way that you can frame it. So it depends on whether he's paid to do the job or not, right? A related position, not quite the same, is the position called apotropos. Apotropos is a Greek term. It means, literally, to keep away. To keep something away. And what it means is someone who's going to keep away harm. An apotropos usually is a guardian who is appointed either by a court or sometimes by a family to take care of the needs of, usually, an incapacitated party. So let's say parents pass away and they leave behind minors who are their children, and the children are not able to run the estate. The family or the court is able to appoint somebody and say, this is the apotropos, he's going to be responsible to take care of the estate. Right? It's a substitute decision maker. There's another word for it besides that. I'm thinking of the SDA, which is the Substitute Decisions Act, but that's what we're talking about. It's a person who is put in the position of being the apotropos, is the guardian for the estate. Well, this question of responsibility for communal funds came up a long, long time ago. In source number 7, you see a discussion from 16th century Israel, but the truth is it's much older than that. It goes back to the Talmud itself. The institution of apotropos goes back at least a couple of thousand years within Judaism, and from the fact that it has a Greek name to it, you know it's not just Jews who had it. We didn't decide, let's make up a Greek name for a Jewish institution. In the case that's being discussed in source number 7, which involved a trust that was left behind, and there were people who were supposed to run the trust for the needy, so Rabbi Yosef Trani in this particular responsum says, those who are able to control funds that have been donated for the needy are just like an apotropos, a guardian on behalf of orphans. Even though the needy people that you're talking about are not minors, and they're not incapacitated, he says, I'll prove it to you. Go back to when the Jews were in the wilderness on their way from Egypt into the land known then as Canaan that would become Israel. Each tribe appointed a person who was their representative for the division of the land. And that person acted on their behalf, even though they were adults, and whatever they decided was binding. So that tells you that there is such a thing as being a guardian on behalf of adults, functioning adults, as well. And this is an idea we can find in sources going back to the 13th, 14th century, stated explicitly that this would be the person's role. And that's another way to look at this director, is that he's the Abutropos. Third and last way you can look at the director, and this is the most fascinating to me because I think it's the biggest leap, but it's actually a very old source, is the idea that you can look at him as a judge, like a member of a rabbinical court. Now, why on earth should this work, that you would be viewing him as a member of a rabbinical court? The answer is because a rabbinical court is not only set up to judge cases, they also have a communal role to look out for the needs of the community. And in that sense, this person, who is a member of the board, is indeed looking out for the needs of the community. That's going to matter a great deal, but I just wanted to show you the source for it. It's source number 8. A passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, which I think in our first lunch we talked a little bit about the origin of the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud, but you're talking about a text here that is 2,000 plus years old, in which we get the following statement in source number 8. You're not allowed to appoint two brothers to serve as governors. The term for governor that's used there is a parnas, a term used to this day, in fact, in Jewish communities, to refer to somebody who takes responsibility for the community. So you can't appoint two brothers to serve as governors together. That's the statement. So much so that they tell the story here in which Rabbi Yossi is in charge of appointing these governors, and he appoints only one out of two brothers who are candidates. And then he makes a public statement. He says, it's not because the other one is a bad guy, it's just that you can't appoint two brothers to serve as governors together. The commentators on that ask, well, why can't they both serve as governors? And the answer that's given is because you can't have two judges on a rabbinical court be brothers. Judges are not allowed to be related to each other. It presents a conflict of interest because they want to support each other. And so therefore you can't do it. And so you can't appoint them to the board together. So yes, what he seems to be saying is that you couldn't have two brothers serve together on a non-profit board. I remember on boards that I sat on for years, there was always the question of whether a husband and a wife could serve on the same board. According to this, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't be able to do that. They're related to each other. But that's the third model. Same thing, father and son, correct. Each of these models for what a director is brings different responsibilities in terms of conflict of interest and has a specific prohibition against conflict of interest. The interests we talk about when you're dealing with this tend to be really on the financial side, with the judge being the exception, as we'll see. But when you're talking about a guardian, or when you're talking about, well, either the shomer guardian, or you talk about the court-appointed apotropos guardian, either way, the concern is really about financial interest. Meaning that, let's take an actual case. Okay, this is the case that I saw in the literature. There was a school that wants to build a brand new dormitory. They're looking for appropriate land. There's a member of the board who has a nephew who happens to own land, and he arranges for them to buy the land off of his nephew. So there you have a case in which you would have a financial conflict of interest, as opposed to a personal one, which we'll talk about as well. But there's all sorts of precedent for saying if there's a financial conflict of interest, then guardians or apotropos are not able to take part. And I brought you two examples. One example is in source number 9. Source number 9 deals with an interesting problem. Let's say I wasn't given a laptop to watch. Let's say someone's going out of town. Jonathan's going out of town. And he says, I need someone to look after the house. So, Torchino, can you do me a favor and watch the house? Okay. Well, I'm only here for the purpose of the story. You should just don't get ahead of yourself. So I go into the house to check and make sure everything is okay. And what do I see? On the counter, he has bags of groceries. That include bananas, that include vegetables, stuff that's going to go bad because he's not coming back for another 2 weeks. So what's my responsibility now? What do I do with the produce that's going to go bad? What would you say?
Yes.
Leave it, put it away, eat it. Jonathan, I'm not going to ask you what you would say.
I don't eat vegetables, so...
I'm going to tell Mia that.
Give it to people who need it.
Give it to people who need it?
It might not even be the owners. I mean, maybe he was waiting for someone to pick it up.
And neglected
to mention that.
Right. So I'm assuming it really is his. Let's say I know that it is. That is his. It's a good point, though.
Yeah.
So take a look, please, at source number 9. If one gives another person produce to guard, and it rots. So, Rabbi Meir, a sage going back to the 2nd century Common Era, says, don't touch it. Leave it alone. Nothing you can do. Because you don't know what he wanted, what he didn't want. Leave it be. Better that than to make a mistake. However, the Chachamim, the sages, say no. You sell it in court. Go to a rabbinical court so that they can give you an evaluation of what it's worth and sell it to somebody. And when he sells it, he should only sell it to others. Can't sell it to himself. He's not entitled, the guardian. I would not be allowed to buy the produce that's sitting in Jonathan's house. They give you another example in the Talmud. They give you a few examples, but I only brought one more example. Let's say I'm a tzedakah collector, not in our days. Our coins tend to be durable. Even our bills are durable. However, in the old days, you had different kinds of coins. Low-level cheap coins were made out of some kind of a copper alloy, and they could deteriorate easily. Then you had the more durable coins, silver, something like that. Those would be longer lasting, and they're worth more. I'm a tzedakah collector. I circulate, and people throw in these cheap, copper coins. At the end of the day, I have a certain number of people I can help, and I distribute to them. And I run out of needy people to help, right? An odd circumstance, but let's pretend. I have more money than I have people to assist. So what I'm supposed to do is preserve the charity that I have collected by trading in the non-durable coins for durable ones. Right? It's the opposite of making change, in other words. I'm going to take whatever the exchange rate is, 10 copper coins, exchange them for a silver coin. I'm supposed to do that, but only with somebody else. I can't pull a silver coin out of my wallet and say, well, I think this is worth these copper coins, and make the exchange, because again, I'm worried about the appearance of self-dealing. There's the concern for me benefiting myself at the expense of the people for whom I am collecting this. So the point is that you see here the concern for self-dealing, the concern for conflict of interest in a person who's assigned to guard the property of others. Yes, well, a stumbling block for myself in that sense, but also a stumbling block for the people who I'm supposed to be helping, who are agreeing, so to speak, to this without their knowledge. The other aspect involved is not only the concern that I am overstepping a boundary, but the concern for appearances.
It's got to look right.
Yeah. It's not just a matter of, will it be, will I do this legitimately? Even if I do it legitimately, people are going to see this and they're not going to know that it's being done legitimately. So that the question comes up, and I brought it in source number 10. Let's say I am an apotropos for an estate. I'm responsible for an estate. The estate has X amount of money in it, and I want to invest it for them. So, hypothetically, I could go to Neil and say, Neil, I know you have a gold mine, so I want to invest it in your gold mine. And if it's a legitimate, realistic investment, which there are rules for in terms of what I'm allowed to do with the estate, then fine, I can invest in Neil's gold mine. So what if I say, look, it would be fine for me to invest in Neil's gold mine. Let me invest it in mine. Right? Why am I investing it in his? I have a gold mine too. Let me invest it in my own. Not allowed to do that. Because even if it is legitimate, there's the issue of appearances. The only way I can do it, as specified in source number 10, is I would need to go to a rabbinical court and have them oversee what I'm doing so that it'll be certified that this is a fair deal. I keep saying rabbinical court. I'm going to come back to the question of oversight in the modern age and whether necessarily it has to be a rabbinical court or whether you can have an outside overseer. We'll talk about it. But what we're seeing here is that there is a concern for financial conflict of interest. There may be something more than that, but right now we're on the level of financial. I'll give you a practical example. Going back to the 16th century, this Rabbi Yosef Trani, who we saw in source number 7, dealt with a very interesting case. There was a trust. A fellow who had passed away left behind a sum of money, which he was to use to support a yeshiva. There was going to be a place where people were going to sit and study Torah. A chunk of the money was assigned to buy homes, which would then be rented out, and the rent would go for the ongoing support of this yeshiva, this place where people were going to study Torah. So that's what he set up. He set up an endowment, essentially, more or less. Well, the person who was the guardian of the trust let his nephews rent out the houses, and he gave them a sweetheart deal on it, in which there was no bidding, in which it was, give me a basic estimate for what you think you should be paying for rent. It was very clearly a sweetheart deal. You think this stuff is new. This is 16th century. They're having a discussion about this. The case comes to Rabbi Trani. It's challenged as, this isn't an appropriate way to run the estate. And he rejects the deal for several reasons, but one reason he rejects it is because he says, you aren't in a position, you as the guardian of the estate, are not in a position to bargain properly with your own nephews. Because you don't want to create strife within your family. And so the result is that the trust is going to suffer. Therefore, you can't do it. You follow? Clear? As a practical matter, and this goes back to the question of rabbinical courts, in source number 11, this Rabbi Dr. Kleinman, who I mentioned before, writes the following, and he's basing himself on an argument by Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein from Yeshivat Har Etzion in Israel. He passed away a couple of months ago. Yeah. So in source number 11, Rabbi Dr. Kleinman writes, a trustee's handling of the property of the trust without prior permission, where it hasn't been vetted in advance. He says, like the guardian who wishes to sell produce entrusted to him, a case like that requires license by the court. The court has to license him to do that. And this requires a court specifically. If I view him as a guardian, then in fact he will need a rabbinical court to approve of his actions.
Are we talking about the fact is that he has to have explicit instructions, i.e., for example, if you have a board of directors, if you have basically a scope of duties, if they are basically published, and if he acts according to those duties, then he would be okay. In the same case, the same thing with here, if, let's say, he had a specific scope of duties that he was told to do, or under the scope of him being the trustee, would he then be able to act and do whatever he would want to do under the...
Well, only if his conflict of interest had been divulged and approved,
right.
You would still require that.
Right. So what would happen in a case where you've got a trustee... The state for the benefit of all the grandchildren of the deceased. This is the son of the deceased. Some of the grandchildren are his.
Yeah.
Some are not his. Their nephews and nieces, whatever it is. What's his responsibility then? Because he clearly has a conflict of interest. Under Jewish law, is that a trustee that's not allowed to be appointed? Or if he is appointed,
right. So I would say two things. First, there's a completely different problem that you would run into under Jewish law, which is that we don't like having a guardian who could come to be perceived by the public as the actual owner of that which he is guarding. Meaning, you take a case like what you're talking about. Let's say there are houses, some real property that are in the estate. And he's managing it, he's taking care of it, and over time, he starts to sort of leak the word that it's actually his. He's not doing it on their behalf, he's doing it on his own, because it was actually given to him within the family, because he has legitimate claim, he's the son of the deceased. So the we have a first concern, which is you don't want to put someone in place who could actually end up taking over the property, claiming that it was actually his. That's piece number one. But in terms of the second, the question of whether you could appoint him, I believe you are able to appoint him as the guardian, despite the conflict of interest. But he would then face a higher standard in terms of the accountability he's going to have to some kind of governing body to make sure that what he's doing is on the up and up. I don't remember specifics about the case that you're describing, and so I wouldn't. I stop short of saying this is what would happen, but generally speaking, the accountability that's required in the texts on this is either an account of transaction by transaction what you did, or alternatively, swearing an oath in court, which is taken very seriously, swearing an oath in court that everything that you did was in fact to the advantage of your charges. Generally speaking, if someone is court appointed, then we tend not... I'm sorry, if someone is court appointed, then we tend to require the oath. If the person is family appointed, we tend not to require the oath, because the concern is that people who know they're going to have to swear in court are going to refuse to serve, because they're going to say, I don't need that problem. And so we don't want to create a disincentive. But in that case, they're going to have to provide a full accounting. And there's a lot of detail about how that's done. They have to make a ledger which stays in the court when they take over, and then a ledger when they leave, stating what happened and where everything went and so on. Like, there's a lot to the discussion of how this accountability works. But yeah, we're going to have to hold them to a high standard of accountability. What Rabbi Dr. Kleinman points out is that we would require oversight. If we call him just a guardian, so then you're going to require rabbinical courts to oversee it. If we're going to call him a public official, though, like a judge, which I wanted to come back to, then any panel can do it. You can appoint a panel of professionals. It doesn't need to be a rabbinical court that's actually going to do the oversight. So what we've said so far, and I feel like it's been a little bit dry, so I'm hoping I'm not putting people to sleep just yet. I have time for that. But what I want to get across is that the position of board member is either guardian, like personal guardian of property, like you gave him something to watch, or apotropos, which could be a court-appointed guardian, or could be viewed as a judge, which makes him a public official, which we still have to talk about. But if I view him as a guardian, whether personally appointed or court appointed, then he is going to have responsibility for financial conflict of interest. He may not engage in anything which stands to benefit him or those even close to him personally. Clear?
If this derails the discussion at all, let me know. But what's the basis for an average person to work and perform their duties together? So as accounting for hypothetically, and is there a Jewish basis to ensure that I'm going to work at full capacity, or can I kind of keep the language off?
You like the rest of us, do.
Yeah.
Right. So the answer is absolutely. There is a requirement which I'm not prepared with sources at hand right now, but yes, there is a requirement in Jewish employment law that you will work as was intended by the person who hired you to work, and that there is a legitimate spectrum within that of what's considered normal. But it has to fit within that spectrum of whatever is considered normal, and otherwise, he would have grounds to either walk away from the deal and any commitments that he had made further, or actually even sue you for recouping whatever he had paid. Yeah, well, it's dishonesty and therefore theft if you end up with the money.
Now, if you pay a salary to work legitimately for 8 hours a day, and for 4 of those hours you're on the internet or something, doing something else, that could be a part of the theft.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, the Jewish law will say you would be required to work up to whatever is the normal standard. There's actually quite a bit of interesting discussion on the point when you deal with tradesmen. What happens if I hire somebody to make he's going to make a chair for me, and I give him the specifications and so on, and we set a price based on what it should cost, And then he comes back to me and he says, you know, I did this really, really well, and therefore I want you to pay me more. More than we had stipulated, because I actually did more than you had expected, but he didn't actually tell me or ask me in advance whether it was what I wanted. That's one sort of type of case that we deal with. And then on the other hand, there's also the discussion of what if, you know, it was supposed to take him 2 days, and now it took him 10 days, and I'm paying him by the hour, as opposed to paying him by the job. But what's very clear in all of the different law that deals with these cases is that there is something called the normal. There is something that is what we expect from somebody else. It comes up also in terms of hours. The Talmud has a discussion, if I hire people to work in my field, so it is legitimate for me to expect them to show up at first light and to work until the sun goes down, unless there is a local norm. If there's a local norm that workers in that particular field of work normally do, then that's what I can expect from them, unless we stipulated otherwise at the time of the original agreement. So yes, the answer is that there is a standard, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, like, in this day and age, I hear about people who are complaining that, you know, I go home at work, my boss is sending me emails, I'm getting faxes, and they say, you know, I'm not supposed to be on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know. And I believe in the states there are certain groups that are trying to sue for overtime pay and that sort of thing.
Interesting. It's certainly a valid point. In an environment in which, you know, you have Jewish rabbinical courts that deal in such matters, it would be legitimate, assuming that there was something that followed up from it. In other words, let's say he refused to answer the email that came in at 10 o'clock at night. And the next day he shows up to work and they tell him you're done because you didn't answer the email at 10 o'clock at night. He would then be able to go to the rabbinical court and say, that's not the standard, that's not the norm, and it wasn't the norm when I was hired. And no one ever said that that was going to be part of the job. And if that's so, they would be able to restore him to his position or compensation, however that would work. So yes, you can't, you know, there is whatever is the norm. Now the question is, so what is the norm? You know, defining what is normal will really depend on the type of job somebody has.
I think it's not always static.
Yeah. And it would depend on what was the norm in your industry, in your area, at the time that you were hired. That's really what would set it. I'm going to go a little further here because I really want to get to the judge, the public official. The public official, or judge as I termed it, is actually held to a higher standard than the director of the board, unless you say the director is also considered like a judge, in which case it'll apply to him equally. The source that I brought you in source number 12 is simple and straightforward, Code of Jewish Law. Wherever a judge has potential benefit from the case at hand, he's not allowed to judge the case. How far do we go? Source number 13, passage in the Talmud says, someone comes to me as a judge. Okay, I am the judge. Someone comes to me and says, listen, I'm one of the litigants in the case. I want you to make sure that you really handle this well. So I'm going to give you $1,000. And what I want you to do is use $1,000 whatever way you want, but make sure you judge the case properly. And he's sincere. It's not properly meaning make sure I win. I'm not allowed to accept that. You can't accept payment from a person who is involved in a case that you are going to handle, even when he wants you to, so to speak, do the right thing.
Yeah. But if you're going to give this to widows, and you're still going to be fair to you as a judge,
yep. That's right. So Harry asks a good question. Why is it that you wouldn't be allowed to accept it? So what do you think the answer is?
Because the person is giving it to you is thinking that you should use it because of the perception.
Right. So perception is a big deal. But the other piece of it is, as the biblical text says, bribes blind people. You may think that you're really answering the case honestly, but the truth of the matter is there is influence involved. The Talmud has a great line. It talks about the word in Hebrew for a bribe. The word in Hebrew for a bribe is shochad. So it, as a play on words, breaks
fraud.
Down shochad.
Fraud. Shochad. Fraud. No.
Well, it's a bribe. Yeah. But it renders shochad as shehu chad, which means that he is one. It unifies the briber and the bribee. You know, you start to see him as an extension of yourself because he gave you $1,000. So that's the concern as well, in addition to the appearances issue. So that's the way it works. I'm going to skip a case which I wanted to bring, but I think in the interest of time, I'm going to skip it. It's source number 14. But essentially what emerges from that is there is a limit to my concern for being influenced. And that is if it's a future thing. It's like it hasn't yet come to pass. There might be a relationship in the future between me and the person involved, and therefore I might have a conflict of interest. It's not a concern if right now there is no relationship, assuming that this future relationship was not guaranteed. So I'll give you a simple case. He's going out with your sister. Now, maybe that's the reason why you would like him or you wouldn't. I'm not sure. But as of now, if he is going out, then there already is a relationship. He's a candidate, so to speak. He's in the field. He's single. She's single. They live in the same area. Whatever. We would not be concerned about that as a conflict of interest. But take a look at source number 15, please. Code of Jewish Law says you're not allowed to judge a case for a friend, even if he's not a close friend. A shushvin is a technical term. In Talmudic times, they had a relationship in which people would be called shushvinin for each other. It meant that they would go to each other's weddings and help provide gifts and so on. And then it was understood the other guy is going to go to yours. But it was required. Like it was almost contractual. So even if the person is not that level of relationship with you, he's not your closest friend, you're not allowed to judge his case. Not allowed to judge a case for somebody you hate either, even if he's not your enemy, you're just angry at him. Fundamentally, that's not allowed either. This is beyond the standard that we had for just the guardian. Personal conflict of interest is an issue as well. And the best cases are the passage in source number 16. Take a look. Defining what they call there a verbal bribe. So they give an example. Shmuel, a sage from the 3rd century, is crossing a river. Someone extends a hand to him. Shmuel says, what are you doing here? He said, actually, I have litigation. Shmuel says, well, I can't be your judge because you helped me across the river. Amemar, another sage, is judging, and a feather lands on his head. So someone takes away the feather. He says, who are you? What are you doing here? Oh, I have litigation. Can't judge for you. You removed the feather that was sitting on my head. Made me look good. Mar Ukva spat. He had some phlegm, whatever it was. Someone comes along and covers it up. Mar Ukva said, what are you doing here? I have litigation. I can't judge for you. And there's a whole series of cases like this that are brought in the Talmud that are far beyond the standard for a guardian. And what we're saying is, if you're dealing with a judge, and the judge is really an example of a public official, then the standard is higher, and any personal involvement is already problematic.
I think maybe you should think about it. The judge is more than a public official, because I think in some ways he renders judgment, whereas a public official is not in the sense of rendering judgment for specific people. Per se, he's a custodian, more like a custodian of the public property, and therefore has a responsibility to make sure that it's guarded. Maybe with the judge it's more onerous, it's more personal, should I say.
See, I think the question really is, why are judges viewed differently? If a judge is viewed differently because he has a responsibility to the justice system, then I agree with you. It's just about being a judge, and it wouldn't apply to others. However, as we saw back in source number 8, the idea of equating the governor with the judge, it could be just that he's responsible for the public trust. And therefore, anybody who serves the public trust on any level is going to be responsible. It's a question of, philosophically, where is this coming from? Why is the judge held to a higher standard? That's really what it comes down to.
I think the judge is held to a higher standard because he's standing for the justice system. Mm-hmm. If the justice system falls down, or is perceived to have fallen down, then society falls to pieces.
Right.
So he's on a double whammy. A, he's got to be independent, and he's got to do it for to be correct. And two, it's what he's standing for. It's the same thing. You don't have to like an officer or a rabbi, but you've got to salute them for their position.
Right.
Because it's a separate issue.
So, right, it's absolutely true, and that's one side of the argument. And that's the argument brought in secular law, I lectured on the topic to a group of lawyers and talked about the standard for the Law Society of Upper Canada. And there, they're very uncertain about personal conflict of interest. I mean, they're very clear, like there's a rule about regarding your spouse. But even regarding a spouse, it's possible to find exceptions to it and allow a lawyer to represent one's spouse. To represent his spouse. No. The idea is, in general, as the Law Society sees it, it's very case by case in terms of figuring out where there is a conflict of interest or where there isn't. There was a recent case in which there were two people. There was the lawyer on the case had been a Facebook friend of somebody on the other side. And the question was, is that really a conflict of interest? I mean, Facebook friendship can mean absolutely nothing. They know somebody who went to college with you, and they saw you on there, and they're looking to gather Facebook friends, and they clicked, and now you're a Facebook friend. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. But that was part of the discussion, is that the lines are blurry within the secular system. What the Jewish system is saying is it's coming down very hard. Now, I shouldn't say this. Let me not say it's coming down very hard. It's giving us models here in source number 16 of personal interest that it's saying you have to watch out for. The reason I don't want to say it's coming down hard is because these are generally viewed as models and not as hard law. A judge would be within his rights to say, yeah, this person helped me across the river, but I feel nothing towards them, and therefore I'm going to judge it. Or if I recuse myself, he's not going to have a panel locally. He's going to have to go somewhere crazy in order to get a court. And he'd be within his rights to say, I can hear this case without bias. But in general, the rules are tricky. I want to just make sure to get to the third part. I'll stick around for questions, but I want to make sure to get to the last part, which is the vote-buying issue, because to me it's the most fascinating of the bunch. This is regarding the citizen's obligation to the community. What is my obligation of not being bought? So I brought you a source number 17. This is from Tosefta. If you remember when we talked about the origin of the Talmud, we said that the verbal tradition that Jews had for translating and explaining the biblical text is written down over a period of generations culminating in the year 220, Common Era, with the writing of the Mishnah. There were a lot of sources that were contemporary to the Mishnah that were not written down. They weren't written down sometimes because of questions about their authenticity, or because they were viewed as redundant with the Mishnah, or because they weren't accessible. There were all sorts of reasons why. Some of them were collected in a work called Tosefta, and that's what you're seeing there. So these are ancient sources. And this piece says, Kofin bnei ha'ir ze'ezel livnos lehen beis ha'knesses. Residents of a city can compel each other to build a synagogue. And Maimonides codified this in the 12th century in his work of law, that they are indeed able to compel each other to do this. I brought a very interesting piece in source number 18 on that. Let's say you have a city that has only 10 residents. They have just dominion. And high holidays are coming, and someone's planning on going out of town to his kids. So now the community isn't going to have a minion. They have the right to compel him to stay locally. Or hire somebody if he wants to be there in his place to make sure they're going to have a minion. All of this is based on the idea that the individual has an obligation to society. I have to look out not just for my own welfare, but also for the public good. This comes up specifically in the context of voting. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in source number 19, says something. This is not his own statement. It's from a responsum of the Maharam of Rothenburg from 13th century Germany. I want to say 14th for some reason, but I think it's 13th. Sorry? No, he was German. Yeah. So he's quoting Maharam here. And he says the following, if you have a community matter on which the people can't find common ground, imagine that. They should convene all the taxpayers, and they should agree that each one will voice his view, here's the key, altruistically. Not based on his personal benefit, but based on the community's benefit. And then they followed the majority. Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer, the Vilna Gaon, comments on this, that this is just like the rabbinical court is supposed to act for the good of the community and has extrajudicial powers to do so, they can ask the community, we want you to act on behalf of the public good. And there was a fascinating case that I brought you a piece of in source number 20 regarding this this issue. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writing in Hungary, the I wrote 18th century, but I think it should have said 19th century, dealt with a case in which the community was voting on a rabbi. They had an interesting way of doing this. They had four candidates. So what they said was, we are going to have give everybody a slip of paper, and we have a box. And they're going to, first, we'll announce, all those who vote for candidate number one, put in your slip for number one. If number one gets the majority, it's over. If not, then all those for number two. And if not him, all those for number three. If not him, all those for number four. They go through this thing, and the third candidate wins the majority of votes. So, third candidate is now the rabbi. And then after a little while, news comes out that relatives of this candidate had actually bribed people within the community to vote for him. So I heard a talk by Rabbi Herschel Schechter at Yeshiva University on this topic. And he said, yeah, you could look at them and say, well, people have all sorts of reasons why they want a rabbi. You know, this one wants a rabbi who has a long beard, and this one wants a rabbi who will give good classes, and this one wants a rabbi who's a good speaker, and this one wants a rabbi who's good with the youth, and this one wants a rabbi who's going to make sure they get money. On the face of it, everybody answers based on their own benefit, so what's the difference? Rabbi Moshe Sofer said, absolutely not. He says, it's as obvious as, and he uses a Talmudic example of an obvious ruling, the kosher of an egg and yogurt. Meaning that there's no prohibition against eating eggs with dairy, so that's obvious that that's permitted. He says it's as obvious as that that this vote is a joke, because they're required to vote altruistically. They have to vote not for their own personal gain, but they have to vote based on the benefit of the community, and on that basis he disqualifies the vote. Now I shudder to think how many communal votes this would disqualify if people really have to vote with the community specifically in mind and not in terms of what they want to see happen. Nonetheless, the principle I think is very important, that in addition to what we said about guardians and viewing the board member as a guardian, saying that he has to avoid any financial interest, and in addition to what we said about the public official, that the public official has responsibility not only about financial interest, but also about personal interest, to make sure he's not going to be swayed. Each citizen has a responsibility to the community that when dealing with communal matters, he's not going to be swayed by his own benefit, but in fact, to look out for the benefit of the whole. Questions?
Yeah. What if someone's quite manipulative and their argument is for the good of the Kahila, and yet they have their own agenda and they're able to work it as if to convince people that it's an unselfish argument and that this is really for the benefit of the altruistic benefit, when indeed it's not.
Right, so I would go back to source number one, right? I'm not allowed to advise somebody to sell his field and buy a donkey because I want his field and I don't want my donkey. You have to give people advice that's in their best interests. If you don't believe it's in their best interest, it's in your interest, then you have no business giving that advice, however persuasively you can argue it. Well, that's the idea here. Meaning, ethics are prescribed for the ethical.
But if
you want to know what we do for the unethical people, that's what we have the court for. But in terms of asking, so what am I supposed to do? That's what we're trying to answer. Neil, you were going to say?
Yeah, but you were saying like people should vote for the benefit of the community instead of their own benefit. But in many cases, they don't know what's really the benefit of the community.
Right.
There's no clarity.
Yep. And when there's no clarity, you do the best you can. You're 100% right. I mean, I'll give you, a classic example. Okay? Let's look at it in terms of being a member of an electorate. Right? So I,